My name is Colt Scroggins, Audio Equipment, Humanities 380, History of Video Games. Today we are interviewing Mr. David L. Bishop, Executive Vice President of Namco USA, and interviewing him is Parnell Tersoro. Date is October 1st, day is Thursday, time is 4:46 p.m.
So the first question is, what was your dream job as a kid?
Oh, wow. As a kid, I'm pretty sure I wanted to be an astronaut or a scientist. I'm not exactly sure which one. I went to school for engineering. So I was going to be at first an aerospace engineer because I thought it was the coolest thing in the world to be able to build spaceships. And in my freshman year, I figured out really quick that it was really just a glorified mechanical engineering, and how much a beam deflects, with a load at the end really isn't that exciting. And so I discovered video games and then got into electrical engineering and fell in love with the game business. So that's how I ended up here.
So going off that, what was your first experience with a coin-op or a video game?
First experience? Okay, so when I was like in high school, we didn't really have that many video games. It was really all about pinballs. That was late 70s. Well, video games were just starting to come out. They were really starting to hit. Most video games were monochrome monitors, pretty basic, the Pong-style stuff. But everybody played pinball. So I probably started playing pinball around the mid-70s, which is really just an exercise in physics. And it's a lot of fun, and you spend a lot of time with that. And I didn't discover video games until probably late 70s, probably about 78, 79, probably about 79, when games just really first started becoming a lot more common. They really exploded around 79, 80. By 81, they were everywhere. But it started with pinballs and gradually kind of moved into video games because that was something really new and cool.
So, like, what was your first video game?
First video game? Wow. The first one I remember, I mean, there were lots of games floating around back then in the late 70s. By 79, I mean, there were a number of games out there. I think the first one I remember playing was when I was still in high school. Or maybe I was just graduating. Maybe it was our senior trip in our high school. Was a game called Starfire. And it was actually really cool because it had a color monitor, which is a big deal. And actually, the game was a big cabinet you sat in.
Yeah.
And it had a little tiny color TV in there for a monitor. And it was when Star Wars came out, originally 1978, 79. So it was right around the time Star Wars came out, and they kind of emulated a Star Wars starfighting game. And it was a really cool game. It was by a company in California called Exidy. But that was the first game I really fell in love with and said, oh my God, this is like the coolest thing ever to be able to play these interactive movies. And so that's when it kind of started. Up until that time, it was black and white things like Gunfighter and Sub-Destroyers and all sorts of tank games and things, really basic stuff. But that was the one that really kind of got me excited about games. That's probably about 79, 78, 79.
That's cool. So in high school, during college, you said you wanted to be electrical.
Yeah, during college, I really wanted to be an engineer. I mean, that was really what I wanted to do. And so I was pretty sure I was going to be an aerospace engineer, like I said. At that time, so I was working for Chick-fil-A, back in the olden days of Chick-fil-A, when Chick-fil-A was still relatively new. And that was a great job. If you're going to work fast food, like, that's the place to work because it's great. I mean, you eat all you want. They're only open 6 days a week, and they're really good people. I mean, Chick-fil-A does this wonderful job with their employees and their team members.
Yeah.
So I worked for Chick-fil-A for 2 or 3 years while I was going to school. And then, arcades were starting to pop up all over the place, on the street and shopping malls. And one of my best friends in high school, got a job at an arcade in Montgomery, Alabama, which is where we all kind of grew up. And it was like the coolest job ever. You didn't have to clean out the fryer. You didn't have to do it. It was all about walking around and giving out change, and you got to play all the games you wanted, which was like, oh my God, this is awesome. So he went to work for the company. It was a little company called Barrel of Fun, based out of Atlanta. They only had like, when I applied with the company, we only had, they had like 10 stores open. That was it. And it was just sounded like a great job. So I applied for a job, and a few months later, I got hired at Tuscaloosa, Alabama, University of Alabama, while I was going to school. And I fell in love with games at that point because in 1981, working in an arcade, you were like a god. I mean, everybody in the mall wanted to be your friend. You had the key to all the games. You got to play all you wanted. And everybody wanted to know you. So it was like really cool. And So that's how I kind of fell in love with games, and I changed to my major to electrical engineering because I decided I wanted to program games, I wanted to build games, and it really came down to a game called Defender. Do you guys know Defender? Awesome game made by designed by a guy named Eugene Jarvis, who lives here in Chicago. Really terrific, terrific guy, terrific game. I played it nonstop. I played it so much I had blisters on my hands. I actually bought, as geeky as this sounds today, so this is like 1981, 1982. I actually bought a glove. They were selling video game gloves at that point with the fingers cut out. They were like goth gloves with the fingers cut off. But because my hand was rubbing up and down the control panel all the time with the joystick, I was wearing blisters on my hand, so I actually had a glove. Played it nonstop, and that was the game that really made me want to get into the game business. And it was amazing. And so I wanted to design games and build games, and then one thing led to another, and I ended up working far on more on the business side than the design side. But it's a living. It's fun.
So would you say that's the particular reason you got into the game business?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was absolutely the reason. I love playing games. I played games nonstop in those days when we weren't working. We were still in the arcade. So every 80s movie you've seen about what it was like to be high school and college age in the 1980s, it was true. I mean, it was really weird. Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I mean, they're all just really wacky. We all hung out in the mall. You go to school during the day. As soon as school's over, you head to the mall. You hang out in the food court. Maybe you go to a movie, but most of the time you hang out in the arcade, get to know all your friends, show off, play games. And I probably spent most of my waking hours. If I wasn't in school, I was probably at the arcade either working or actually just hanging out playing games. And that's how it started. And I fell in love with the business. I wanted to be in the business from that point forward, and I have been. Ever since then, I've been in the game business. I got lucky. I was in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. So what was like your favorite experience working as like in the arcade?
Oh my gosh. most of them I can't repeat. there were some amazing ones I won't put on tape. But it was great. I mean, in those days, I mean, it was literally, I mean, so we're working in the arcade part-time, but they were small. There were 2,000 square foot arcades. We'd have 40, 50, 60 video games in there. Now, when I started, it was half pinball and half video, but eventually a video quickly started pushing the pinballs out. I still love pinballs to this day, though. I think they're fabulous pieces. A nice pinball is a terrific piece of equipment. But it got so busy, and like a Friday or Saturday night, trying to walk from the back of the store to the front of the store, which is it's 20% of the size of this facility that we're in today. It's very, very small. It would take 20 minutes to walk from the front of the store to the back of the store because you get stopped every 3 feet. Somebody needs change, somebody needs help with the game, and it was so amazing because everybody in town was at the arcade on Friday night and Saturday night. So you made a lot of friends, you got to know a lot of people, and it was a lot of fun. I mean, it was a glorious time. It really was. I can't even. I look back on it. I'm like, oh my god, that was so much fun. It was terrific. I can't even explain to you all the cool stuff that happened at that point. Made a lot of friends. You know, really interesting time.
Do you still keep up with the friends?
Some of them. I mean, some of the ones that we stayed. Some of them we all worked together for the company, and I've known some people in this business for decades. You know, so I've there were a couple of guys I've worked with for 30 years. And they kind of all started the same way I did, and then we were so in love with games, and it was so cool, we just wanted to be a part of it, and we all stayed together, working forever. So, there's a few. I mean, let's face it, most people you don't stay in contact with, but there's been a few that we've hung out with a long time. So, to this day, I still talk to, and some people I haven't worked with in more than 10 years, we still talk once in a while, and Facebook's really helped with that, things like Facebook, and we're still friends. I'm friends with guys on Facebook that we haven't really seen each other in probably 20 years, but we worked together for a really, important part of our lives when we were early on, and we've stayed in touch ever since.
So working in the arcades, how did you end up working for Namco?
Well, back in those days, arcades were popping everywhere, and there's a lot of little mom-and-pop arcades popping up, and then the chains started coming up, and you had a few major chains that were starting to pop arcades all over the place. And so I was working for a brand new chain called Barrel of Fun, and like I said, they only had like 10 stores when I started with the company, but they were starting to pop it. It was really southeastern United States mall type stuff. And there were a lot of much larger players out there. So we started, we were growing, we were opening new locations. And in the early 80s, new arcades were popping up every week. I mean, there were new arcades popping up everywhere. And so we started growing, and then the bottom fell out of the industry, probably around 1982, 83, somewhere in there. It suddenly was like, we went up like a rocket. 81 was just incredible. 82, late 82, it started coming down the other side. And by the end of 82, the business had just kind of collapsed, the coin-op business. And, you know, so everybody had to retrench, kind of rebuild themselves, and the video game business went to heck. And there's a lot of reasons. That's a really complex subject. But a lot of it was the you know, video games were a fad to a large degree, but there were more than that. But at that time, they were just so popular, and they became such a large part of pop culture that it wasn't sustainable the way that people were all over it. And it needed to kind of reset, and it did for a lot of different reasons. So what happened was everybody kind of retrenched in the arcades, and then we had to learn to do something besides just the fad video game. Yeah. And we struggled for that for a couple of years, and then we got into ticket redemption. You know, we discovered, you know, the skee ball machines, they spit out tickets and you get little prizes, and we discovered crane games. We put in one single crane into a video game arcade, and suddenly the arcade revenues doubled, and half the revenues are coming out of this one crane machine because people had seen them on Jersey Shore or in carnivals, but no one had ever seen inside a shopping mall before. So the business exploded again. And at that time, Namco owned Atari Games, half of it. They owned about, I think, 51% or 50%, roughly whatever it was, of Atari Games Corporation. And Namco started pushing Atari to get back into the operating business. Namco was founded as an operating company. They were literally, our company was founded in 1955 in Tokyo, Japan, with two kiddie rides on the roof of a Tokyo department store. And it's always been an operating company first, and then we started designing games and building games. But back in those days, Namco wanted Atari to start owning arcades and owning its own locations again, and so Atari started looking for companies to buy. And long story short, they ended up talking to our company based out of Atlanta in Georgia, and a deal was done. And so my company, Barrel of Fun, became Atari Operations Inc., and I went to work for Atari. And then they moved me to California from Atlanta, which was a massive culture shock. I can't even describe that one to you. Moving to California after living in Georgia and Alabama was a really different experience. Loved California, but incredible experience. I mean, just the cost was staggering. If I had been smarter or a little older or a little bit wiser at what I was doing, I never would have done it because it was insane. I mean, the cost difference was huge. I was so excited to go work for Atari. Oh my God, I'm going to work for Atari. I would have done anything at that point when I got out there. Literally, we went out there. They flew us out there. We're going to look for a place to live. My wife cried the entire first night. It was like, oh my God, we can't afford a shoebox here. But it didn't matter. So we went to work for Atari, and that lasted about 3 years. And then, long story short, Namco and Atari kind of went separate ways. And Namco sold all their stock in Atari back to Time Warner, and we established Namco operations. So I stayed with Namco. Mm-hmm. And that was 1990, and I've been with Namco ever since. And we started building Namco up at that point. But at that point, Namco, literally, they only had an office here in the U.S. in, I think it was Mountain View, California. There was one guy that did licensing, and he licensed every game to Atari. So, you know, and he had like two female assistants. So it was kind of cool, but there was nothing there. So we took Atari operations, made it Namco operations, started redoing everything from a Namco perspective on our arcades and our game business. And then initialized game manufacturing, because up until that point, all the Namco games were being done by Atari. And before Atari, they were done by Bally Midway here in Chicago. So like when Pac-Man and Galaga and Galaxian were being built, those are Namco games, but they were licensed to Bally Midway. And then when they bought Atari, from the mid-80s to 1990, everything was done by Atari Games in the U.S. that was Namco. And then after about 1991, we started releasing them under our own name. So it became Namco at that point.
So when you moved from Alabama, what did you do in Atari?
Whatever they needed, Diana. So at that point, we had, I want to say we had about, we weren't really big. We had maybe, 25 mall arcades, not real big, 25, 30. I have to go back and look. I don't remember the exact number, but... So I was, there was me and another guy that were kind of primarily running the arcade chain. And I moved out to California and he stayed in Atlanta. And we kind of split the country in two. And we didn't really have much west of Mississippi anyway, so I moved to California, and we started building stuff on the West Coast, and we started building things west of the Mississippi. And so what I was doing at that point was kind of setting up the new business in the western half of the U.S. and building arcades and building, you know, going out and designing and building arcades and putting them together in malls. And you know, it was what you think of. I mean, it's just there were 2,000 and 3,000 square foot arcades full of games.
So was the coin app industry different from California than where you were from, or is this kind of similar?
I certainly perceived it as different, you know, but part of that could have been, you know, when I lived in Georgia, I was working for a small independent arcade company. And when I moved to California, I was part of Atari Games. I mean, so it was a very different perspective, because Atari Games back in, you know, mid-80s, I mean, they were one of the dominant manufacturers. Certainly from a video game standpoint, you could argue that Atari Games was, you know, one of the people that really made video games work in America. Today, I'm biased. I mean, I would say Namco really made Atari Games, I mean, video games work. If you think back about Pac-Man, it really established the video game genre, but even in the early days, the early video games, all those early Bally Midway games that were really popular, a lot of them were Namco titles, you know, the Galagas and the Galaxians and the Mappies and I mean, all these beautiful titles from the early days. So Namco really kind of set all that stuff up. But so going from a small arcade company to working for Atari Games, it was really different perspective. I mean, I got to be involved with the manufacturers, with the R&D teams. It was fun. So I got to I got to see the guys as they were developing. They'd call us in regularly. We all worked in the same building, so it was a lot of fun. And we got to see the new games in development. I got to talk about it. I got to give my opinion as little as it was worth about what we needed in the arcades. But, you know, and that was a different day. And game development in those days was really all about coin-op. It was really all about the arcades. So the consumer games, you know, we were still kind of looking down our nose at consumer-level games at that point. You know, the NES had kind of come and gone, or Atari. I should go back and say the Atari 2600 and the 5200, the old Atari home games, they were there and they kind of went away. And we really were kind of like, well, consumer games, home games can never do what we can do in the coin-op arcades. You know, we'll always have something bigger, faster, more immersive in the arcades. We weren't really smart looking forward enough, but because you can do some great stuff at home now. But it was a little bit different animal. So everything in the game business revolved around the arcades and revolved around coin-op. And being at Atari was like a dream come true. You know, I'm still a pretty young guy, and I got to be at Atari Games, and it was like the heart of the game business, video game business anyway, at that point.
So how did you end up moving from California to Chicago then? And how was that different in the coin-op business?
So we were in... working for Namco has been an amazing experience. And in the early days at Namco, the founder of the company, Masaya Nakamura, was very involved. And he's still around. I mean, he's not very involved anymore. Still a major stockholder. But in those days, he was very vital, and he's very involved in everything. And he really wanted us to grow. And so he was over here on a regular basis from Tokyo and talking to us about growing and pushing us to grow the company. And you know, we were growing, we were adding locations, but then opportunities started coming up to do acquisitions. So for the first maybe 2 or 3 years, we were just doing growth organically. We were doing leases, 10-year mall leases, and building these arcades and putting them out there and stocking them up. That's too slow.
Yeah.
So long story short, there was a company based here in Chicago called Aladdin's Castle, which had been previously owned by Bally. And that we had an opportunity to purchase Aladdin's Castle. And we did. We cut a deal and bought the company. And one day my boss looked at me in California and said, "Well, one of us is moving to Chicago, and it's not going to be me." And I said, "Okay, I guess I'm going to Chicago." And we did. And it's been great. I've lived in all parts of the country. This is the first time I've ever lived in a place with snow. I mean, in California, we live in San Jose in the Bay Area. The weather really doesn't change much year round. The only difference between winter and summer, all the grass is, they call it golden, it's dead, it's brown. Winter, it's green, because there's enough water to make it work. But that's really the difference. Otherwise, in San Francisco, you could go out there and wear a coat in August. I mean, there's enough, the temperature really is not that variable. I had a house in San Jose, didn't have air conditioning. Didn't need it. 1 week out of the year, it was hot enough I needed air conditioning. Otherwise, you just open the windows and It was beautiful. Grew up in Alabama, Georgia. You know, I needed air conditioning most of the year. But either way, never real cold weather till I got here. And when I moved here from California, I was thinking, oh my gosh, Chicago. I was envisioning this you know, tundra and ice and snow on the ground 12 months out of the year, or maybe 9 months out of the year. And I just couldn't imagine what it was going to be like. And I like Chicago. I've really come to enjoy it. Now, we moved here in 94. And it's been great. I've been here ever since. This is the longest I've ever stayed in one spot in my entire life. So I've been here since 94. And it's been great. But it was really different again. It was financially... You spend just as much money as you spend in California, you just get more for it. You know, you're not living in as much of a shoebox here in Chicago as you are in California. But it wasn't as much of a culture shock. Actually, it was really cool. So my wife and I, we didn't have kids when we lived in California. We just had my daughter right before we moved. And it worked out really well because the whole Midwest family values thing is real. I mean, it really is a difference. In California... You know, everyone's really nice, but you don't really know your neighbors. I mean, I knew the person directly across the street from us, and you've met the people on either side of us, but everyone works really hard during the week, and on the weekends, they scatter, because you can go to the ocean, you can go skiing in the hills. I mean, and no one really hangs out in California, because they're all doing their own thing. And so we're used to that. It's like, okay, well, you sort of know who your neighbors are, but that's really it. You don't get really heavily involved in them. And we moved here to Chicago, and like we're moving in, and people are knocking on the door, and they're bringing pies to us, and it's like, can we play with your daughter? And I'm like, oh, this is weird. I shouldn't even be meeting you for 6 months, much less you guys coming and talking to us. So it was really different, but it was fun. It was really good. It was a great place to raise a family compared to California. I mean, I like California, but it's not great for family, I don't think. Not as great. I shouldn't say that. Sure. Gonna make a lot of people in California really angry at that statement, but I loved California living there. I think it was great being there with my family early on, but raising a child was probably better here in Chicago.
Nice. So, considering Namco's origin, have you ever been to Japan? And how was your experience?
I love Japan. I love Japan. I love Namco. I mean, I feel like it's part of me. You know, I've probably been in Japan. I've lost track. I don't know, 30 times. I don't know. Yeah. So it's interesting. It's very different again. When I went to work for this company, I had never had sushi at all. I didn't know what sushi was. I grew up in Alabama. I mean, if we had fish, it was catfish, and we fried it, and that was it. There wasn't going to be anything else. So I didn't have sushi until I went to work for our I think it was Atari or Namco. I can't remember which. I think we probably had some. You know. No, I don't think I ever had any raw fish at Atari. I don't think I had sushi until the day that we did the changeover to Namco. And so I had to learn a whole new culture. But I love Japan. It's fabulous. It's a lot of fun. In those early days particularly, it was great because we'd go to Japan and we'd spend a week over there and we'd go through the entire R&D department and they'd bring out all the guys with all the R&D guys. They had hundreds of engineers. And they'd come out with these game ideas and concepts and we'd get to talk about it and have some input on what they're doing. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of work. And as much fun as it is, I mean, the game business is it's still a business. And it's probably not nearly as much fun as it looks from the outside. But, you know, I can't imagine doing anything else. It's been a great experience. I meandered all over that question. I'm not sure if I answered it all right or not.
So where in Japan did you, like Tokyo? Or?
Yeah, mostly Tokyo. Most of my trips have been to Tokyo. I've done a few other places. But our headquarters is in the suburbs of Tokyo, so that's where we spend most of our time. Yeah, but it's fun. You guys ever been?
No. Hopefully.
Planning on it.
It's an amazing culture. It's great. I feel more comfortable in downtown Tokyo than I do in downtown Chicago. Part of that's because I'm probably more familiar with downtown Tokyo than I am Chicago. Yeah. But it's really safe. You feel very safe. I've been walking around downtown Tokyo at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning after having a couple beers too many. And it's incredibly safe. Everyone's very friendly. You just feel good. And it's very easy to navigate. Having a car is the worst thing you can do. You learn to use the trains. The transit system is awesome. It's an amazing transit system, and it's fast. And it's you could set your watch by when those trains arrive and leave. They are flawless. So it's a pretty amazing place. And it's really easy to navigate. It's really great.
So I'm guessing you know some Japanese too.
I know enough to get in trouble. That's about it. So I early on tried to, you know, talk and say a few things and try to exercise my skills, and I figured out really quick that's a mistake. Because the second they think you might speak a little Japanese, understand, then they start talking to you in Japanese, and I don't understand a word. I mean, you maybe get a word here and there, and I'm like, okay, this, I don't even say anything anymore. Yeah. I mean, even if I understand a couple of words, I don't say anything, because it's just too hard to carry on a conversation. And the last thing I want to do is give someone the idea that I may actually understand what they're saying. So, you know, and I think the Japanese tend to do the same thing, unless they're very comfortable with English. I mean, most Japanese understand English relatively well. But, you know, a lot of them won't speak it because they're not comfortable with it, and they don't want to, you know, they want to give you the wrong impression. But, yeah, it's actually, I find it a difficult language, because I wish I'd learned it, you know, 20 years ago. I wish I'd really kind of dug into it and tried to pick it up. But, yeah. Fun culture, if you get a chance to go. I love the culture in Japan now.
So, how was it like with the coin-op industry in Japan? Is it like different from here, or is it like
Yeah, there's differences. I mean, it's really kind of funny. You go to Tokyo now, and it's still they're still much more traditionally focused on the arcades. So here, there aren't that many arcades out there anymore. I mean, they're really fine. I mean, I can remember when there used to be one every few blocks. There was another arcade. Every mall had at least one arcade. Some malls had two arcades, and then there were all lots of street corners and stuff. Today, it's pretty hard to find arcades. And the real dedicated arcades today, we have about 1,000 locations that we operate, but there's only maybe, I don't know, 2 to 3 dozen that are arcades, real arcades. Most of them are smaller game installations that we do, like we'll do games in a theater lobby or things like that in front of a retail store. And that's a lot of our locations. This is the other end of the spectrum, obviously. But Japan still has what I would consider very relatively traditional arcades. Where you'll have, you know, good size arcades with 100, I mean, they're crammed, they're tight, but you'll have 100, 150 games in there, video games, maybe multiple floors because everything's, the geography is so tight there.
Yeah.
But a lot of video, a lot of fighting games, a lot of music and rhythm games. Today, it's a little bit different. There's a lot of crane games. So, I mean, the big chunk of the business are all cranes. Crane business works very different than it does here in the U.S. In the U.S., Americans are all about winning. So if I have a crane game, I'm going to have a bunch of stuff in it, and you want to walk up to it, drop a quarter in or drop a dollar in, depending on what kind of game, crane it is, and pick up something and win it. You know, that's it. It's just it's the art of the win for an American. I just want to win, and I want to win it in one shot. And then I won.
Yeah.
In Japan, it doesn't work like that. You don't pick anything up. The cranes, the claws come down, and basically you just kind of knock the stuff around. And you kind of pick it up and flop it around, and you try to get it closer and closer to the hole until it falls in. Everything is winnable in Japan. You can absolutely win it. The skill in Japan comes in how many times am I going to have to hit that and touch it and knock it around until I win it and let it fall in. So you're not going to win it in one shot. And really it's all about, I call it, it's more of a retail experience in Japan when they're doing merchandising games. Because every game has exactly one game, one item in it. You know, if this one has Pac-Man plush in it, that's all it has, Pac-Man plush. And this one's got Ghost plush. And, you know, or maybe this one, maybe this one's got Blinky and this one's got Pinky. You know, this one's got calculators. This one's got, and you walk up and down the aisles of cranes and you pick out the item that you like. And once you pick out the item you like, then you do the calculation. I mean, it's going to take me 10 times to win that. Do I want to pay $10 to win that calculator? And that's what you have to kind of calculate in your head, because everything there is 100 yen, about a buck to play one game. And, you know, there's 50 yen shops, you know, but that's, they're kind of like downscale, the discount shops, and it's not the same experience. But if you go to a Namco arcade or a Sega arcade or a Taito arcade, they all tend to be, you know, 100 yen or 200 yen. And for the brand new games, it can be 500 yen to play. I mean, so it just kind of depends on what you're dealing with. So the price point's a little bit different. Still very much a family experience, too. It actually cuts across the demographic spectrum. So it's much more socially acceptable to play games in Japan than probably here in the... I mean, when I was growing up, my parents were all like, games? It's like, you know, I played D&D when I was in high school. I played video games. It's like, you know, I was practically a drug user at that point, right, as far as most people, as far as most adults were concerned. In Japan, it's always been very socially acceptable. It's always been something that grandparents can do with the kids and with the parents and family. It's an experience that everybody accepted and kind of embraced. And here in the U.S., for a lot of years, it was very segregated. It was just, it was very, back in the early days, it was very much a male, young male, yeah, teenage male. It was testosterone driven. I mean, and to this day, it probably still is. Video games really are, to a large degree. And I say that, my daughter will kill me for saying that, because she plays games all her life, too. And she's 22 today, and she still plays games, so... but it's still predominantly, there's a lot of males involved, and it tends to be that that one special area, except that we're starting to see the wave of nostalgia kind of coming back now. So suddenly it's not just the hot new game, because if I'm going to play a hot new game, then I'm playing Halo or Destiny at home on my Xbox, as opposed to let's go out and let's be hang out together, spend some time together, and hey, let's play some Donkey Kong while we're out here. Let's have a couple of beers. I've got a couple of great craft beers here. Let's play some Donkey Kong. Just relax and just have a good time with it. It's in the U.S., we're just seeing a lot more of that starting to come back now, where it's becoming a lot of older people that didn't, that kind of left games. You know, I never did, but a lot of, I have a lot of friends that kind of grew up with me with games, and they got real jobs and went on and kind of stopped playing games. And now suddenly they're coming back to games saying, oh, God, I remember doing this when I was, you know, 20-something years old, I was playing Centipede, and now they're kind of doing it again. And it's, there's this whole nostalgia wave coming back across. People are starting to collect it more. It's becoming much more collectible. Old games are tough to find now. So, but very different. Japan's still very traditional. Still, everybody plays games all the time, and it's just it's a different environment to this day.
So, as VP at Namco, so what do you usually do? What is your specific job?
Okay, so I mean, currently what I do is, well, the last couple of years I've been concentrating primarily on what we think are the ways we're going to expand out of home entertainment in the future. Mm-hmm. Level 257 has been kind of the flagship of that. We're talking about, it's really not about just games. Games are part of our DNA. I love games. I mean, games are fabulous. But I think out-of-home entertainment is a lot more than just games. I think games are an integral part of what you do to entertain yourselves. But it's really about how we help people, how we enable people to socialize with each other and have a good time out of home. Mm-hmm. I can have a lot of fun at home playing a game, and I can play with my friends. Playing at home to me is a very social experience because you're on the headset, we're talking. I spent a good year or two of my life on World of Warcraft, and you know, we had our own Namco Guild, for gosh sakes, you know. we were really going at it. But for us, what we're talking about, we want to be able to let people have a great time and spend time together, and we have to be the enabler for that. Games are one tool, and they're an important part of what we do, but food plays an important element of that. I mean, entertainment begins with food, I think.
Yeah.
And then a lot of things go along with food. I mean, obviously, food and beverage is a big deal for us. And this Level 257 concept was really designed for less of an arcade frame of mind, but more of an entertainment frame of mind for adults. I mean, we really said, well, we want to do something. I've been doing this my whole life. I love playing games, but I also want to have a great bottle of wine and a great beer. So... lost my train of thought. Sorry, I got distracted there for a second. So basically, Level 257 was all about trying to find ways that we could help people have a good time. And part of it's playing games, part of it's bowling, part of it's having a great meal, great bottle of wine, some fun craft beer. We're having a lot of fun with craft beer now, particularly here in Chicago. There's so many microbreweries.
Yeah.
But that's what I do with Namco. So it's look at out-of-home entertainment and trends and how we apply those trends.
Do you plan on opening more locations or adding new concept ideas?
Yes, absolutely. You know, entertainment is a constant evolution. I mean, we're constantly looking at what's working and what's not working. And this was because this was a new prototype, we knew that not everything was going to work. We had a lot of ideas. We wanted to try a lot of different things. And some stuff has worked incredibly well, better than we expected it to. And then other things have done what we... We're afraid they might do is that they haven't really panned out the way we thought. So it's been a situation where we've learned an awful lot in a short amount of time. And yeah, the next iteration I think will be a lot better. And then as we start to evolve this and build more of these, I think it'll hone in a lot better as we go.
So thinking about the future, what do you think about the coin-op industry in general? Do you think it will keep growing, or be stagnant, or become obsolete, or?
It's changed a lot. I mean, it's not the business it used to be, you know. But entertainment is not what it used to be, and I think it's okay. It's okay. I mean, everything changes, everything evolves. You know, we'll probably never build locations just to put games in anymore. I mean, games are an important element, but it's an element, like everything else that we do as well. Mm-hmm. So, I think that as far as coin op goes, you know, the term coin op kind of makes me a little crazy, because how many coins do you have in your pocket right now? I don't have any. I mean, most people don't carry a lot of coins. They don't carry cash. So we have to change how we look at how you do payment systems, how you do play. Level 227, we want to try a very different paradigm of play here. So there's no per-play pricing. I mean, we did that for decades, and it worked. It made a lot of sense. But for this particular environment, because we were trying to be very adult, and we're trying to make it very accessible, so the people who come in, we want to do games for people who don't normally play games, maybe an older crowd. You don't play per game. You just say, hey, I want to play games for an hour or 2 hours, whatever you want. And we give you a card, and for the next hour or 2 hours or 15 minutes, whatever you sign up for, you can activate any game in here, whether it's a, you know, 35-year-old Pac-Man machine or it's the brand new Star Wars Battle Pod. Doesn't matter. You can activate every game in here. You don't have to worry about how much it costs. I don't have to worry about, you know, I don't know enough to play this. I'm wasting my $3 to activate this game. You don't worry about it. We wanted to make it really, really simple, because I want everybody to play games, whether they're a gamer or not. And that was kind of one of our fundamental philosophies here, is to make this incredibly approachable. I really want to get people playing games who don't normally play games anymore. We wanted to kind of bring everybody back that kind of quit, come back and try it again. It's a lot of fun. And as part of that, we want to introduce them to all the new stuff that we're doing. They recognize the Asteroids and the Pac-Man and Galaga and all the cool stuff we used to do, but I really want to show them, you know, Dead Storm Pirates and Dark Escape and Star Wars Battle Pod, the stuff that's come off the assembly line the last couple of years, was really fabulous stuff. And that's kind of our subtext here, is how do we get people excited about playing games again? And then I want to show them the new stuff that we're doing to get them kind of exposed to what's happening today. There's still a market out there for out-of-home entertainment with games. There absolutely is. It's changing. It's not what it used to be. Games are a lot more expensive than they used to be. You know, $2,000 in the early 80s was an expensive game. But, you know, it was a game. You could buy, you know, pretty much any game out there. $1,500, $2,000, you know. You get your Donkey Kong. I remember driving to Atlanta from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, to go get a Donkey Kong when it first came out. I was like, oh, my God, this is a fabulous game. Today, you know, you can't buy much for that. And some of the new games we have cost five figures and up. So they're kind of crazy. The investment level is huge. So you have this kind of this polarization in the game business today. So kind of the haves and the have-nots. You got the really big, elaborate locations that you probably know what I'm talking about. Where you have 200 games in a giant facility, and have, you know, I mean, they'll serve alcohol and food and everything, but it's really all about this 200 games in this space, and it's a beautiful job. I mean, they have beautiful games, and they have everything new, and it's really expensive. It's a really expensive layout, and it's per-play pricing, and it's very confusing how it all works. And then you have the guys at the other end of the spectrum, but they can afford to buy everything, and they do a great job with it. And then there's the guys that can't afford to buy everything. And so now they've got to go back and figure out, well, I can't afford to keep up with these guys at this end of the spectrum, so how do you position yourself so you can make something work? And this is why you see things like the barcades popping up all over the place.
GameWorks?
GameWorks is, they do a nice job. GameWorks, really, the big GameWorks, like one here in Schaumburg, they do a really nice job. It's more of a traditional arcade model, to be honest. They're doing their new stuff. They're building is actually a lot more interesting, because they're adding a lot more of the non-gaming elements to it. So I think the food becomes more forward in some of their newer locations. This one is really, from my perspective, is really about games, primarily. But then there are guys. What I'm really interested in seeing lately are all the barcades. So it's all the Logan Hardwares or the Headquarters, you know, downtown. These guys are doing these really cool things, and the games are, we took a page out of that book to do Level 237. The games aren't necessarily the center focus. They're there, but it's really all about entertainment, and a lot of that may be food, it may be beverage, it may be beer, but it's really about the package, and the games are one element, but it's not the primary element, not necessarily. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that coming on, where you have guys using games, and games still are a pretty vital part of that out-of-home entertainment. It's a good way to socialize and hang out with your friends, but it's not necessarily the main reason that you're coming out to do it. It's like, hey, I'm going to go out. Let's go out and have a good time. We're going to have we'll have some appetizers. We'll have some great craft beer, and we'll play some games. We'll just hang out. And you see that a lot. I'm seeing a lot downtown Chicago, a lot of that popping up. A lot of the urban, a lot of the cities will pop, a lot of it's popping up inside the urban environment. So you'll see more and more of that.
The barcades?
Yeah, the barcades. Yeah, it's really about the barcades. Different investment level, though, because they're not buying the brand new stuff. I mean, so what you'll see is some great places, and they have some great, a lot of 30-year-old equipment or 20-year-old equipment, but they won't have the brand new stuff because it's... The economic model doesn't work. I mean, to be able to buy that and put it in location, it's a tough model. And the guys that make that work are the guys like, you know, the obvious guys like Dave and Buster's, and here in Chicago, Round One, in Bloomingdale, where they have these really great game rooms, and they have a massive amount of new games, and they're putting a lot of money out to put in the brand new equipment. Tough for most operators to do that. I mean, that's a really tough model. And so that's why I think you're seeing a lot of the barcades. But the barcades are coming up, and there's more classic, not much new games. Different environment. And then you got guys like Galloping Ghost, you know, Galloping Ghost down in Brookfield. Great guys. They've got, I don't know, almost 500 games now. I'm sure by the time someone listens to this, it's going to be a lot more, because I was down there this week, and they're going to be expanding again and adding more games. And I think they're officially now the largest arcade in, if not the U.S., maybe in the world. But they're amazing, and they've got all these great old games that are, it's almost collector items now. I mean, a lot of them I haven't seen. They have some in there that I never saw. I don't even remember those games coming up. But you know, and again, that's another model. So games, there's lots of different ways to play games. There's lots of ways to operate games and still make money. And it's just a matter of trying to find an economic model that works, but it's out there. And so I think it's still a business that you can make a lot of money at. You just have to be a lot smarter about it.
So, 7. I mean, right now, what is your, like, working for NAMP, what is your favorite memory so far? Or, like, something you enjoy that sticks in the mind?
You know, There's a million great memories working for Namco. It's a great company. I've been with them for a long time. So I've had a Namco logo on my paycheck since 1990. So it's a big deal for me. But, you know, I think I said it earlier. I mean, the best job I think I ever had was working part-time in an arcade, because it was just an amazing time. And this when games were at their peak. But even today, I mean, I love going to Tokyo. I love looking at new games. I love getting to try new technologies, where people are going, when you start talking about head-mounted displays and building virtual worlds that you can roam in. I mean, there's so many cool things that are happening out there, and the technology, the pace of change is accelerating. So it's really, it's amazing some of the stuff that we're doing today and the stuff that we're talking about for our, not even long-term, but very short-term. There's going to be some really cool stuff coming out commercially available. And I love that stuff. I think it's really fun looking at technology, but at the end of the day, you just have to keep in mind that you can't do technology for technology's sake. And just because it's a really cool technology doesn't mean it's going to be fun to play with. At the end of the day, it's still about building a great story, a very compelling gameplay experience. And the technology is an extra layer on top of that. But it's fun to look at. I enjoy the heck out of looking at all that stuff and how we can apply it to let people have fun.
Do you think you'll apply those virtual realities to
Yeah, you know, we've talked about it a lot, and we talked about what games. So right now, the games we have, we've got this really kind of this split personality on our games here. We have these really cool classics that have been completely restored and renovated, and then we've got these brand new games that we want to showcase once you get you playing the older games. To add the high tech, but none of it's high tech. A lot of it was chosen to be social or intuitive. So we specifically chose not to get maybe the best video games out there. We chose to get the games that would fill the niche. When you start talking about things like virtual reality and head-mounted displays, and there's some really cool stuff coming, and I know a lot of the guys are working on this stuff, and I just think that you start to get to a point where it starts to become too high-tech for the mass market, I mean, for people at large. I think if you're a hardcore gamer, you can be all over it. But if you're, hey, I'm just... you know, Joe American, and I just want to go out and have a good time, and playing games can be part of that. And I kind of put myself in that category. It might be too much, you know, because it's not necessarily intuitive how to play a lot of those games, and you have to start. So even the games we have, like some of the immersive games, we have some games upstairs. We have a couple of games that are, it's like I tell people, it's like sitting inside half a ping pong ball, hemispherical screen.
Yeah.
So you've got this real peripheral vision thing going on. Really beautiful games. They're kind of an experience as much as they are a game. But a really neat graphical presentation. And it's a lot of fun, but they're not that easy to play. And it's easy to become disoriented if you don't know how to interact with a game environment. And so I look at that, and I look at the people that are playing it, and I'm saying, you know, we're skating a really, you know, hard line there that says, you know, if we get... There's a lot of cool stuff you could do, but I'm not sure we should do it for the mass market. If it was all hardcore gamers, yeah, I think it'd be great. It'd be really kind of cool. But we're trying to do something here that I think is approachable by everybody. And it's not necessarily the most social experience, but there's some awesome stuff out there. I mean, from a technological standpoint, it's great. I'm just not sure how much of that we'll implement. And there are games we've chosen not to implement here because we were afraid it was too hardcore. You know, I don't have a late model Tekken game upstairs, you know, because we, and it's a great game. I love Tekken, but it was too typical niche, you know, hardcore gamer mode. We wanted to make it much more approachable, so we chose to have games that were kind of spoke to everybody at large, not just a very small set of really dedicated players.
Do you think you'd open a facility just for hardcore gamers?
We talked about that. We whiteboard a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And we've talked about going the other extreme and just saying, hey, what if we did a really hardcore, high-tech experience? And we've got some things out there like that. We could talk about that. And if we come up with a really compelling idea, we could certainly go there. And there's some stuff in R&D right now that's really pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And I'm not quite sure how it's all going to fit into play. And we'll just, I mean, basically a lot of these things, the fun part about the game business, a lot of technology, particularly in the early, if you go back to the 80s and 90s, a lot of things, we were playing with things in the game business that really weren't necessarily polished, you know, for a public presentation. But it was okay. It was like, it's not a weapon system we have to sell to the military, it's a game. So let's try this. Here's a new chip. Let's see if we can make this do what we want it to do. Let's get a better graphical system out of this. And we did a lot of experimenting. That's kind of the fun of games is, you know, it's not generally a life or death situation, so you can experiment. And there's a lot of experimenting going on. And I think the game business has allowed us to kind of push the envelope a lot when we start talking about new technology. And I think that'll continue. Absolutely. I know it's going to continue.
I mean, is that what you're working on right now or for the future, like versus like a broad type, just any?
You know, my focus right now for where we are and where we're going I'm kind of going the opposite direction here of what I just talked about.
Yeah.
And I love technology. I'm a tech geek from way back. I've always have been. But we really kind of wanted to go the other way and say, hey, can we just help people have a good time? And if the technology plays a part in that, great. If it doesn't, well, that's okay too, you know. And so it really is not about the specific game technology or the really having the cutting edge technology out there. It's really about just how do I help people have fun, and that's a constantly moving target. And right now we're choosing to do it this way, but in 6 months we may say, you know what, let's go back and try this. And that's the fun of a prototype like this is you get to do a lot of experimenting, and you get to say, I have a theory that A equals B. Let's test it and see. And if it actually turns out that A equals C, then we've got to back up and retool a little bit.
Uh-huh.
You do that all the time. So I'm not going to say we'll never implement any of the technology, but you know, it's not what we're focusing on today for this concept.
Yeah.
Now, another concept's another story.
Speaking about technology, you talked about having an electrical engineer background. Were you able to like fix a machine if it was like broken? Or?
Yeah, I can fix anything that's 30 years old. I can pretty much fix it. If anything newer, it's not necessarily so well. But I did at one point in my career. I was, everybody did everything in the early days. You didn't have the staff to segregate duties. So I was our head technician for a number of years. I worked in our office in Atlanta before I moved to California, and I was the parts buyer, the technician, the receptionist that answered the phone, and the part part-time district manager. They went out and did audits of stores. So, yeah, I mean, but yeah, in the early days, it was fun. That was one of the appealing parts about the game business when I first started out, being a nerd, a techno nerd, was we did all the repairs ourselves. And all you needed was a good logic probe and a voltmeter, and you could pretty much work on anything. And the systems were slow enough back in those days that I could take a logic probe and just see, yep, I can see an AND gate, and I could see the changing state on the, and we'd literally look at the pins on the chip and say that one's not working or that one's working. We actually did a lot of troubleshooting in the early 80s, fixing a lot of games with a logic probe and a meter. That's all it took to fix logic boards.
Even like the refurbished machines upstairs, you can still fix those too?
You know, I'm not as good as I used to be, but I could find my way through it. I mean, the hardest part, I probably spent a lot of years in the early days. I mean, everything was like those, you know, when you start talking about Pong and things like that, there were the raster monitors, you know, where it draws the raster across the screen and it changes the intensity of the electron beam. Then they went to the vector beam monitors. And so there were a lot of vector beams where it literally draws the picture with the electron beam, like Tempest or Ripoff or Battle Zone, if you remember, where the beam didn't go across and it actually just drew the picture. And we had a lot of monitors like that. I spent probably a good few years doing nothing but working on those monitors. And they were, it was a weird animal. It's not like they were made for TVs or anything. They were specifically made for our product, for doing games. And I can probably still fix those today. I know most of them. I still remember the parts that go into most of them. I can still fix them. There aren't that many of them. Vectors upstairs. We've got Lunar Lander, which is from 1979. It's just a fabulous little game where you have to land your lunar lander on the moon. It's an old black and white vector beam. But yeah, I can still fix those. And I can, push comes to shove, I can fix most pinballs.
Do you have to hire anyone? Can you just fix
them? You know what? It's probably not the best use of my time to be out doing all the game repairs myself, but I can do it in a pinch. I've helped out on a few occasions.
Yeah.
It's fun to do. I like fixing games. It's almost relaxing. If you like solving puzzles, it's really just about thinking logically. And if you know how it works, you just got to work your way through it to troubleshoot it.
Does it bring like nostalgia back?
Yeah, it is. No, it's fun. It is. I mean, so I saw we've got some guys here, and you know, taking care of pinballs is actually a really laborious process. Pinballs take a lot of time. I love a pinball that's well maintained. If the play field's waxed and every light works and every solenoid works, it's a beautiful piece of equipment. So we're trying to train these guys to do it because nobody knows how to maintain pinballs anymore.
Yeah.
They aren't that. They're really not something you do commercially and make a lot of money with. Select locations can do well with them. A lot of them go into the home today. They're collectors that buy them. But it's still, they're tough to maintain. And the guys that make them, there's only a few factories that make them. The primary factory that makes pinballs today in the world is here in Chicago, in Elk Grove, Stern Pinball. And they do a fabulous job. And they've got them designed so that it's hard to mess them up now. You don't have to put all the labor into them. We've got some older classic pinballs up here that go back to the 70s. And those are old school pinballs, electronic pinballs still though. But you really have to wax the play fields once or twice a week. You've got to go back and clean all the rubbers on a regular basis. And it's a lot of work. So it could take, you're going to put an hour a week into a pinball machine just to kind of maintain it, just to keep it cleaned and waxed. So it's actually kind of fun to do that stuff because when I was a part-timer, that was how I spent half my life, was cleaning pinball machines. Kind of nostalgic, kind of doing all that. It is fun.
So were you trained with this or is this like, they taught you or you had to learn first?
Yes and yes. I mean, yeah, they teach you a little bit, but in those days, again, in the early 80s, I mean, games weren't that complex. I mean, they're actually really simple. You open up the box, and the box is mostly air, and there's a little logic board, and there's a power supply, and there's a monitor. You know, that's pretty much, and then there's a control panel and a bunch of wires, but basically wires and contact switches. I mean, you can sit here and you can work your way through it, and you can troubleshoot it pretty easy. There's not much to them. So in the early days, yeah, a lot of it was self-taught. It's like, we used to teach guys electronics. I remember in the early days, we hired a lot of guys out of the military. You know, they did a few years in the Air Force, and they had some electronics experience. We'd bring them in and teach them how games work. And, you know, games, it's actually, most of them work the same way. They may have different power supplies or different chips and making up a logic board. Fundamentally, it all kind of works the same way. And once you know how the pieces fit together, you can do it. You can work your way through it. So a lot of it is self-taught. And to this day, a lot of it is self-taught. There aren't really schools that teach you how to troubleshoot video games. Today, if you go to school to learn electronics, you go to DeVry and you get an electronic technician degree, a lot of what they teach you is how to troubleshoot down to a subsystem and say, oh, this is the bad board. Throw it out, drop a new board in. So we can't do that. We have to troubleshoot down to the chip or down to the capacitor or down the resistor. So we're really getting down to component level. And there's not a lot of places to train to that level anymore. So, yeah, a lot of it is self-taught.
So, so you're speaking about some of your greatest memories and greatest times in, like, over the time in the game industry. What are some of the times, like, that there's a failure or failed, like, you wish you could do something better about it?
Times that we fail and we wish we could do something better about it.
Like times you can learn from. You could have done better.
That's like every week. About a lifetime of, we kind of laugh about it sometimes, and everybody makes mistakes. You're going to make mistakes all the time. And, you know, you beat yourself up. And there are mistakes I made even on this project, you know, that in retrospect, I wish I'd done it differently. But we talk about it all the time and say, you know, if you don't make mistakes here and there, you're not trying hard enough. You've got to make some mistakes, and as long as you learn from the mistakes, and then you go on, you just can't repeat the same mistake over and over again. But I tell people all the time, it's okay to make a mistake. You got to learn from it, and then we got to adapt it and move on. But we're always making mistakes, and the trick is just trying to learn from it and not to beat yourself up over it too much. But man, we've made some. I make mistakes to this day. I mean, on this project, I mean, I couldn't count how many mistakes we've made that I said, okay, next time I know how to do this a lot better. And that's true. And there's a million things I've learned out of this about how to do a 40,000 foot facility a lot better. And I know next time we can do it faster, cheaper, and better. We won't work because we've had to do things and had to back up and redo them because we did it wrong the first time. But we've done a lot of things that no one's ever done before. And in retrospect, there's a reason why people hadn't done it, and we had to learn the hard way why they didn't do it. But we wanted to try out a lot of different things. You know, this is a big facility. We wanted servers to be able to serve you something from anywhere. So we have wireless tablets. We have this massive wireless network system in here with Cisco routers and access points, and it's a really robust wireless system. It wasn't cheap. But everything works off a wireless tablet. They can order a drink from anywhere. It immediately goes back through the wireless system. So the drink order drops off at the bar. If you need a new shoe for the bowling lanes, it goes back to the shoe room. If you want an appetizer, it goes back to the kitchen. It all handles it all automatically. And then runners bring everything out that you've ordered, so the server doesn't have to walk halfway across the place to try to do it. We had to build all that from scratch because nobody really does that to the level we're talking about here. And the systems didn't exist, so we had to go back and do a lot of custom proprietary programming. No one gives us credit for that. No one really cares. The guests don't really see it. We didn't want the guests to see it. This is all back-of-house stuff, but there's a lot of things that we had to experiment and try to make work, and not all of it worked. You know, we said, okay, well, this wasn't as easy as we thought it would be, and you learn from that, and you move on. So, but yeah, stuff we've done here, there's design stuff I don't like. There's a big disconnect between upstairs and downstairs. Fundamentally, we're about to change that. So we're redesigning the downstairs right now. Storefront didn't turn out exactly the way we wanted. The bowling, the workflow for bowling didn't work the way we wanted. We wanted it to be a really premium experience. And you sit down and somebody brings your ball to you and cleans it off and presents you the ball and brings your shoes out to you. And it was a really cool idea. It was a very premium experience. Figured out the first weekend, wasn't practical. You know, we didn't want the balls out there. We wanted to make sure they were all clean and sanitized. Yeah. And it really didn't work. We tried it. We couldn't make it work. It was too hard to get the ball in your hand so you could start bowling. It took too long and really slow. And so we ended up, we kind of gave up on that and said, you know what, the balls are out there. We'll come wipe them off and stuff, but we're not going to bring the ball to you that you need for your size and everything. It's just taking too long. So we tried a lot of different things like that. And a lot of it seems really simple, but we started this, when we did this project, we said, let's throw away everything we've known that's correct for the last 30 years. And so just because eventually you start to do the same thing over and over and over again, you buy your own propaganda, and you forget to question, why am I doing this? So we threw everything out, and we let the game room design was done by people who don't know how to design game rooms. Yeah. And the bowling design was designed by guys that don't normally do bowling. So we took our teams and we swapped them and said, okay, you work on bowling, and you work on games, and you work on the restaurant, and that way we get some really fresh ideas, and we did, and we made some mistakes too, but you got some really great ideas out of it. And I think you've got to constantly challenge yourself or you're never going to get better. So we don't sweat too much about making mistakes because you know you're going to make a few. And that's part of the process. And I think that's true in everything we do. When we're designing a game, you got to push yourself. You got to try.
So with the tablets, is it an app or do you have a tablet upstairs?
So every server walks around. They've got a tablet on them. They've actually got a wireless tablet, and they can do all the orders on it. So every one of them upstairs. So if they're walking around, if you're in the dining room, you're placing an order for your dinner.
Yeah.
They're doing it on a wireless tablet. Or if you're in the bowling lane, we could serve you on the bowling lane. So if you're on one of the lanes and you want to order a drink, she's doing it on the wireless tablet. And she doesn't. So the beauty of that is, most places you have to give your server the order,
yeah,
and they have to walk over to a computer terminal, and they got to type it in. Then they walk over to the bar. And they get your drink, and then they walk back to bring it to you. And they spend 6% of the time walking. It's crazy. And this is a 40,000-foot facility. This is not a 3,000-square-foot restaurant. So we said, that's not going to work. So the whole idea here was how do we let the server stay with you and talk to you and build a relationship with you, and then but still get your orders in and get everything out there, and then have someone else bring it over so that she doesn't have to spend 6% of her time walking, because that's a waste. So we had all these ideas like that, and we thought through everything. We thought through the bowling, we thought through the gameplay, we thought through the dining room, we spent years talking about all this stuff until we came up with, here's how we're going to workflow all this. And, you know, it's a lot of it's worked out really well. Some of it hasn't. And you just got to go back and retool it.
So speaking of, like, hobbies, like, what games, like, do you play most often?
What games do I play most often?
What do you like the most?
I spend, you know, different times in my life, I've really gotten into different stuff. I mentioned earlier, I mean, there were a few years I lost my life in Warcraft, like everybody, like most of America. And we had a hardcore group of Namco employees in different parts of the world that were all kind of working together on the same server. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed the hell out of that.
You
that was a blast. Do what?
Do you work and play at the same time?
Well, no, we didn't do that. No. Although part of my work, we're in Tokyo, is playing games. I got some great memories of playing games in Japan. But I like socially interactive games. I mean, or thinking games. So I spent a lot before I got into Warcraft. I was spending a lot of time on real-time strategy games, mostly PC gaming. The last few years, I'm doing a lot more role-playing games, mostly on Xbox. Xbox is probably my console of choice at the moment. So I just got through, or I'm just finishing up Dragon Age Inquisition. I like BioWare and Bethesda are probably my two favorite manufacturers of role-playing games. Very different types of games, if you know those two guys. I mean,
yeah.
It's the, you know... It's kind of, so I love games like Fallout or Fallout 3. I spent a lot of time on Fallout 3 from Bethesda, but I also spent a lot of time on a number of the BioWare games, which is Dragon Age is a BioWare game. Different systems. I mean, Bethesda tends to have wide open worlds,
yeah,
and you can get lost in the game track. I mean, you get off on some side quest, and I've literally forgotten what I was supposed to be doing at sometimes because I spend hours. I'm so anal retentive of how I play games. I got to pick up every freaking tin can. I got to do every little quest. And then I forget what the main quest line is. And the problem with that is sometimes you get a little bored and you start wandering off. And I forget, oh, this is not as much fun as it was because now I'm just being obsessively collecting things.
Yeah.
BioWare tends to have you a little bit more on a rail, so they don't let you get too far off the main path. At least until Inquisition. Now, the previous Dragon Age had you on a rail. Inquisition's got a little bit more you can get lost in. But I like role-playing games. It's more of a... It's for me, it's a diversion. It's the one time I don't think about, oh my God, I should be doing this at work, or I need to get this accomplished, or we've got these goals we're not meeting.
Yeah.
You know, and so when I'm playing a game, it's the only time I get to not worry about what I missed at the office, or what I need, my wife wants me to go do, or I can just concentrate on playing the game and just and having a good experience. And for me, that's how I relax, is playing games.
During class, I remember like one time in an event, like when they would keep score with all the machines, like the high scores.
High score tables, yeah.
Did you ever wanted to get high school, like participate in,
you know,
an event like that?
You know, we talk about a lot. I know a lot of quote champions on games, and I was and the guys down at Galloping Ghost, we were talking about earlier, do a great job at that. They've got high scores on other games. I think Galloping Ghost is probably one of the places that people go to set their high scores, world records on.
Mm-hmm.
Got a lot of world records set down there. You know, the guys that do that, they take it really, really seriously. And it's really important to them. And I don't think I'm hardcore enough to be able to do that. I mean, I'm not disciplined enough to sit there and play for hours and hours and hours and hours on one game to perfect, you know, getting that high score. And those guys are special. They really are focused on it, and they really are good at it. And you know, that takes a lot of discipline. So I'm probably not that disciplined to be able to do it. And I don't think I tend to be competitive. If I can't think I can win, I'm probably not going to play. So I'm like
I mean, that concludes all my questions. Do you have anything else to add, or?
Wow, anything else to add?
Something
I thought. You know, it's been. I mean, there's the history of games has been. It's been really neat. I mean, there's a lot of research I'm sure you guys are doing right now on games. Massive roller coaster. We've had some real highs, some real lows, but it's a process, and we're not finished. I mean, games are evolving. And for us, I think it's going to be really interesting to see where games go next. It's just they're becoming incredibly immersive. I like that. I love games that become immersive, that really, really suck you into the storyline. Technology is not as important to me as story. And I talk to a lot of people about, every college out there now has degrees in game development and game design. And the game business is tough to get into. And it's really tough to, it's a tough business to live in and work in. But if you really want to get, as important as it is to know how to program or to do graphic systems, I think it's more important to know how to tell a story. Because the future of games is really about getting people immersed into your story. And even a first-person shooter, the storyline is becoming more and more important. And it's a big deal. So, I mean, you're always going to have that subset of people that wants just nothing but pure action, first-person shooter, just frag fest, you know, just kill everybody. But I think it's more important to really talk about, you know, how you develop the storyline. So I think the future of game development has as much to, and it holds as much attraction for English majors as it does programmers, because it really is, it's a new media. It's how do you tell a story? It's like being a filmmaker now. It's all about how do you tell a story and how do you get people really tied up in the story. And in that regard, it absolutely is an art, and it absolutely is a lot of fun. And I think people that are really interested in that, it's a beautiful process. So I love games.
Speaking of, what was your favorite game that told a story?
Favorite game that told a story.
Before like the 2000s.
Favorite game, what was the first game that really told a story for me? I mean, we talked earlier about Myst, and you know, Myst was a genre changer. I mean, it was so different from the games that we were playing at that point, and there really was a story behind it, and it really sucked you into the story. I love Dragon Age. Not because it's a really great, hardcore game series that has a great combat, programming, but it's really about this fabulous story, and it's a really immersive and very deep story that you can get into. I love games that tell stories. I mean, the Fallout series, great storyline. Dragon Age. What else? Now I'm just drawing a blank now. BioWare game, space version of Dragon Age. What am I thinking of?
Microsoft
did. I played the heck out of it. I can't remember it now. So it's like they're coming out. They're coming out with a new version.
Yeah,
okay. Well, you know what I'm talking about.
Mass Effect.
Thank you. Oh my god, I can't believe I had that that brain lock. I love Mass Effect. Great storyline.
Yeah.
Really, really deep storyline. The games became more complex as you got further into them. I don't know if you guys have played them all the way through. I'll say the ending of the third game really angered me. But it angered me. In retrospect, I was angry for about 2 months at the ending of that game. And after I got past it, I said, you know what? I'm angry because I really got sucked into the storyline and I didn't like the finish. And that's good. You know what? Because it's not the way I envisioned it, but I was so it was so personal to me, the story, that I think it was good. That was very successful because it sucked me into the storyline. And I love games that do that. And I think I get a little upset when I see a lot of players that are just playing for the action and they're not playing for the story, because you're missing so much of it. And you have to get a little bit older and really start appreciating the games for the storylines behind them. But there's some beautiful storylines, and I've seen a lot of people just kind of blow through the story and say, I'm not going to read all that stuff. Let me just go in and shoot something.
Didn't they add a DLC for the ending?
For that they did. They did. So you could, because it was the first endings were, they were kind of vague, and then they added on some of the downloadable stuff.
Did you like the ending for
that? I did not, my ending I did not like. I will say that. I really objected to my character dying in the end. So I think that was a spoiler for anybody that hasn't heard that. It was very upsetting. So, but it was good. It was good because I was really into the storyline. So I love games that tell stories, or that are puzzles. So I do a lot of, when I say puzzle games, that are logic games. So I'll do a lot of that. If I want something quick and easy, I'll do a logic game. But if I've got a few hours to spend, then I'm going to go into a really heavy story like game, a Mass Effect or a Fallout or a Dragon Age, something like that. It's just fun.
Like what kind of puzzle games?
Puzzle games? So if I'm going to play something on my phone, I'm going to whip out my phone and I'm going to play a logic game on my phone where, those are not puzzle games. Something with a little more logic to it than that. Nothing against those games. They're great. A lot of people play them. That's terrific. I think any game that people enjoy is good. If you enjoy it, everybody's got different tastes, and I'll never put any game down. And I think it's crazy to say, those games are awful. It's not. It's fun. If someone enjoys it, it's great. It's okay to play whatever you like. I like to play games that, that if I'm doing something quick, I'll just play. I've been playing a lot of the New York Times crossword puzzle lately, just on my iPhone, because I can sit down and I can do it for 10 minutes, then walk off, and it's fine. But that's for the short games. For the longer games, I'm going to do the other stuff, though. I love console games today. Although I'm firing up my PC rig, gaming rig, and I haven't had a PC gaming rig going for the last couple of years, and I've been getting the urge to go back and play some old PC games again. So I've been working on that for the last 2 days, trying to get it running again.
Are you planning to get the new games coming out this fall?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I'm dying right now. What's coming out now? Fallout. Next Fallout's coming out real soon. Halo, I liked Halo, and it's actually a decent little story. And I kicked myself because I never finished the. I did the first one, got part of the way through the second one. I don't think I ever finished the second one, and then I never finished any of them more. I just moved on. You can't play every game, as frustrating as it is, because you can spend a lot of time playing games. You just can't do it all. But I try. I love games. But I got to go back to do Halo again. I want to do Destiny. I haven't played Destiny. So I want to go back and really try that. I'm scared to play a really immersive game like Warcraft. A large, massively multiplayer online game, because it'll suck the life out of you. I don't know if you guys ever done it. I had the monk in my back for a good year and a half, 2 years. I don't know. I probably spent more time online than I did offline. It was that bad. I mean, there were days we like, okay, work's over, get home 8 o'clock. Okay, everybody, let's meet up in this one spot at 8 o'clock. We'd all have our headsets. We'd be playing, and they say, "I know the sun's coming up," and we've been playing all night, and it got to be a little cumbersome there for a good year or so. It probably was destroying my family life. The only way my daughter got to spend any time with me, she started playing, so we would play together, and that was. That was actually fun. It was fun. We had a good time with it. But eventually you gotta say, okay, I gotta balance your work life thing here. So, tough.
So funny to hear that. The game that got me into MMORPGs was RuneScape, and I just remember playing that.
I never played that one. I came close. I mean, somebody suckered me into Warcraft, and it was like I successfully avoided playing this because I always heard. Going back to EverQuest, and everyone called it EverCrack, and I figured out pretty quickly, like, there's a reason everyone's doing this. I don't want to get involved in that. I don't have time to do that. And so somebody thought it was funny. Someone at Namco, one year at Christmas, thought it would be funny to give me a copy of Warcraft. And I was like, I got it. I got to go install it now and try it out. It's like, if I'd had to buy it, I probably never would have gotten it. Somebody bought it and gave it to me. Said, here, go put this on. And that was a mistake. So I put it on, and the next thing I know, I'm hooked like everybody else. And a bunch of literally... at one point, I think a good third of our office was all playing at the same time together. And it was fun. It was fun. We've got, to this day, we still laugh about stuff that happened, because it was, when you're playing a game like that with people that you really know, and you know well enough that you can laugh and kind of talk about, and it becomes this real socially bonding experience. And there were lots of things, literally, we could to this day talk about when this one event happened, or, you know, when one of our guys got the heck beat out of him by a bunch of the other guys, the Alliance guys, because we were all horde, came over the hill and they started beating the hell out of him, and I was on top of the hill watching him saying, guys, we got a problem. And we just swooped in and just kicked their butts and just wiped them out because they didn't know we were there. And it was just fun. It was just so much fun stuff. Or when guys had so much to drink, they just passed out and fell on their keyboard, and their character took off running into a tree, into a bunch of mobs. And just all this really fun stuff we talk about. And it's a lot of fun with great memories. I mean, I had a lot of fun doing that. But it'll suck the life out of you.
Yeah. Just throughout this whole thing, I noticed that friendships and creating a bond or relationship with the other person you're playing with has been a big thing. Do you think you could, like, elaborate any more on it? Because, I mean, you've explained a lot, but is there anything you'd want to say more about the bonding aspect of gaming?
Yeah, you know, and that's been a lot of what we talked about for the last 5 or 10 years. We've had a lot of conversations about, you know, gaming is a tool to help people interact socially. And that's really, to us, that's a fundamental part of the process we're going through right now. Saying, look, it's not the end all. The game is a way that we help people do this. It's a tool, and so a lot of what we're doing now revolves around how do we just get people to interact and to bond and have a good time together. It's all about socialization, and we probably spend more time talking about the social aspects of everything we're designing and developing than anything else that we do. It's like, how do you get people to work together on this stuff? And I say it all the time: we're supposed to be social grease. That's our job. We're there to just grease the runway to make it easier for everybody to hang out together and have a good time. Whether we're hanging out in the bar and playing some of your games and having some great beers, or we're hanging out together online and we're playing a game together online, and it's still a very social experience. I mean, playing Warcraft to me was an incredibly social experience. And all the online RPGs really are. They can be very, very social if you play them properly. You can play them solitary, but it's not as much fun. They become fun when you got other people that you can play it with, and that's the beauty of it. So we're spending a lot of time talking about how we develop more of that in the future.
This is a really open-ended question, but if you could craft your own game anywhere, you could explain anywhere from characters to storyline or whatever, like, how would you explain, like, the game, your perfect game?
Wow. That's a very open-ended question. I'm not sure what a perfect game is. From my perspective, it would be incredibly immersive and very social. And if I could have a Star Trek 3D holodeck version of Warcraft, that would be, like, awesome. You know, where you could really be there in real life. And I think about that. And a lot of the things that are being worked on are like that. You know, where we're trying to get you more immersive and play those same games, but play them so that you're much more sucked into the action. And then I started to worry about, is it too immersive? You know, are we going too far? Is it too much? And a lot of the cool stuff that's being done right now, the technology behind head-mounted displays is moving so quickly. I'm staggered at the quality of some of the head-mounted displays today that you can see. And they're amazing. And I remember what was it, in 1990, mid-1990s, 95, 96 range, virtuality was really the first commercial virtual reality. We had commercial units where the big ring, you stood in the ring and you had the big headset on. They were really crude, but we had them out there. And we had a bunch of them. They were really neat. At the time, they were cutting edge. But the stuff that we're developing right now is amazing. It's almost scary how good it is. And I start to worry that, and I'm sure along the way, for decades, people have been saying the exact same thing. It's like, oh my God, is this video game too immersive? Is Mortal Kombat, is that too realistic that you're ripping someone's spine out? Not that I've ever seen anybody rip a spine out, but I'm sure people are always worried about that. But I think about it, it's like, you know, you get to a point where how realistic does it become? You know, if I'm starting to feel like I'm really in the environment and I'm using augmented reality with head-mounted displays, and so I can see things that are really look like they're really there in a real-world environment, at what point do you start to lose the separation between, hey, this is real and this is not. And I've actually started thinking about that lately as I look at some of the stuff that's being worked on that's, you know, not tomorrow coming out, but in a few years it'll be out. It's like, wow, this is really cool, but you know, how are we going to deal with this stuff later on? And I think I'm fascinated by that. I'm fascinated by disruption. I'm fascinated by anything that says, hey, this is the way this has been working for decades, and now let's throw it away. You know, I'm fascinated by how Apple threw away the music industry and started over again. How digital downloading of music replaced CDs and you know, how books are being replaced. You know, used to be every mall used to have an arcade, used to have a toy store, used to have a bookstore, used to have a music store. A lot of that stuff doesn't exist in shopping malls anymore. It's because it's all been disrupted. And there's technology is allowing us to do so many really cool things. It's really disruptive. And that's kind of half the fun, is disrupting what we've been doing for decades and finding a different way to do it. And you're seeing that a lot in technology and games, I think, right now, is that the way we've been doing it is not the way we're going to do it going forward. So I didn't answer your question because I think it's really hard for me to say what is a perfect game. I don't know. It's it'd be something very social and very immersive. That's all I know. But I have to think about that one.
Well, being a longtime employee of Namco, what would you say are some of your favorite game franchises, Namco branded?
Namco branded game franchises that I really love. I love Time Crisis. I always thought the Time Crisis franchise was awesome.
Yes.
It was awesome because of the blowback on the gun. I mean, there were lots of gun games out there, and a lot of them were incredible. But here was a game where I had the blowback, and it was a beautiful franchise. I played the heck out of that. We've got Time Crisis 5 upstairs. It's a really wonderful game. The latest version of Time Crisis. Have to go play it before you leave. It's a great game. I always liked, when you come to fighting games, I always liked the Soul Calibur series. I wasn't a Tekken player. I was more, and the guys that are really into Tekken, I'll tell you, because I'm a button masher. Tekken takes some skill. You gotta know what you're doing. You gotta know what you're playing, and skill really matters. Soul Calibur, Soul Edge, not as much. You know, a good button masher that's flopping underneath the buttons, you can still hold your own against somebody else. So the skill level is a little bit different. It's dialed in differently, and I feel like as a non-hardcore fighting game player, I can hold my own in a Soul Calibur game with most people. I've always loved Soul Calibur when it comes to fighting games, probably over Tekken. What else really cool? Other than that, I'm probably going to go back and look at the classics. You know, although the driving games were always great, even the classic driving games. So going back to Pole Position, which was actually released by Atari here in the U.S., but then Final Lap, Final Lap 2, Final Lap 3. We've got some great drivers. Mario Kart, which everyone loves Mario Kart at home. We've got the commercial version. I mean, so we've got, I love our Mario Kart implementation with Pac-Man in it. So, and again, it's not because it's a great driving game, it's a realistic driving game. It's not, it's just fun. It's just stupid fun. It's just, we can, three or four of us can get up there and we can play together, and it's, the rubber band's really tight, so, you know, the game's never going to let one person get so far ahead that it's, you know, it's not competitive all the way to the end. And it does a great job. So I love games that are fun like that. When you're talking about coin-op games, which is much different than consumer games. I mean, the home games. The home games, the skill level is going to be a much different setup, so that skill matters much more. You can have a much more realism. You can take a much longer time to learn how to play it. With coin-op, you've got to be it's got to be intuitive, it's got to be really instant, and it's got to be competitive, so that you can't let skill generally let one person get so far ahead of the other person, so that it's not a contest. Because coin-op games are all about us having together a lot of fun together in 2 or 3 minutes of fun, and just you've only got a few minutes. You got to get in there and you got to have fun all the way through from the beginning to the end. So it's a different type of gameplay, and I love those type of games. I love racing games on multiplayer racing games, and I think Namco's always done Ridge Racer, Dead Heat. We do now Mario Kart, which is kind of silly fun. It's fun. I love those because it's competitive. It's just fun. It's meant to be a social game.
Speaking about franchises, I know Japan has started a lot of game franchises that haven't really sold well and kind of stopped on it. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Tale of Tales series, but
I am familiar with it. You know, Japan, Japanese style games, that's really kind of a Japanese RPG game. You know, the audience, it's kind of a niche audience in the U.S. for that. I like those games. Actually, my daughter plays a lot of those games, and she loves those. Not something that translates to us in a commercial environment, you know, trying to do that. You can't really do a coin-op game with that. So it's kind of this very specialized market, but they're still playing with it, and they're still, you know, working on new ones, new iterations. So they're out there. Yeah, I like them. Small, you know, small subset of the market, though. Not small, but it is a subset.
Would you say that Namco really does care about its, like, gamers, like the market they're selling to? Because it seems that even though you guys still make games for the masses, you still leave a little for the hardcore gamers.
I think so. I think that, I mean, Namco, and really, I mean, Namco's part of the Bandai Namco group now. It's a big global group. But at the end of the day, it's really about a bunch of guys that really like to entertain, that like games, and there are different types of games, and we have different R&D groups that specialize in different types of games. And I think every one of these groups take what they do very, very seriously. They're really hardcore about what they do. Some it's more casual, some it's, you know, really, there are games that we do that are fabulous games that I hate them, because I don't like, I play a game to never die. I play a game to, you know, and there are certain games we've done in recent years. It's like, you're going to die. You're going to die a lot. You're going to die often. And you're going to, it's just like rinse and repeat. Not, you died. Okay, start again. Try again. Not, you died. You got another foot. You got to, so you got to do it. You got to die over and over and over again. Those games drive me crazy because it's like I feel like I'm successfully failing over and over. But I know that people that like those games love them. And I think there's a lot of attention. We've got games like that in development to this day. I mean, so people love that. And I think that what our group tries to do is we try to give people what they want, you know. I mean, that's part of it, is and sometimes give people, you know, I know we've done things that necessarily weren't the most popular thing out there, but it was important to the guys that were making it to do this particular game in this certain way. So I think they care. I mean, I care. I believe all of our guys care. So yeah, I would say yes.
This might be a little backtrack, but if you had to choose one single game title or coin op that spurred you towards this career in gaming, which one would it be?
Defender. Yeah, Williams Defender. That was my game. I played that for months on end, and I got to be really good at it. Today, I'm trying to remember if I have, that's upstairs. I've got a Defender. I don't think it's upstairs on the floor. I actually own a Defender myself that I've kept for years. But I was actually told the guys to get it ready and let's put it on the floor and let people play it. It's a great game at its time. It was a very complex game at its time. And I liked it. I think part of it was because I was much more, when I was younger, I was much more of a hardcore gamer. And Defender was about as hardcore as you got back in those days, because it had like 7 buttons, a joystick, and it was a really complex game when most games had a paddle or maybe a couple of buttons, you know, or maybe a joystick. I mean, most control schemes were pretty simple. Defender was a very complex control scheme, and there was a lot going on, and you had to be doing a lot at the same time. You had to watch your radar, you had to watch what was going on, you had to line everything up for the shots exactly. It was a tough game, and but that was the game that really said, "Oh my God, this is like the greatest thing in the world. I want to do this for a living." And that was it.
From before, you said that when you were working at the arcade, everybody wanted to know you. Would it be fair to say that you were popular?
Well, I was definitely a geek nerd. I mean, but most of us were. But it was like, yeah, if you worked in the arcade, everybody. I mean, like the manager Ruby Tuesdays across the hall from us. It was like he was a hardcore gamer. Came in and played Galaga every day. He was our buddy. So the next thing I know, it's like if I walked into Ruby Tuesdays, I was going to get some free beer. Yeah. And he would come over every day, and the manager was going to let him play a few games of Galaga. You know, and you got to be friends with everybody. There was a lot of dating that you picked up in the arcades in those days. It was really cool. I mean, I dated a lot of girls that were hanging out in the arcade all the time. It was an amazing time where people were all kind of sharing in this common. It was such a big deal. Games were such a big deal for everybody in America. I mean, for that 1 or 2 years, that's all anybody talked about. It was on TV, it was in music, it was on radio. It was all anyone talked about was It was either disco or video games. That's the only one he really talked about. And I felt like the arcade king at that point. You know, it was amazing. So if you had a job at the arcade, you were like amazing. I got lucky. I was in the right place at the right time. And there were like four of us that worked in the arcade. And you know, like everybody in the mall knew us. If you wanted to play games, they knew who we were. I think in our own little weird way, we were very popular. it was fun. It was fun. It was a lot of good times.
Thinking back on that, would you say you've seen any major cultural shifts or changes in attitude towards gamers now, like in today's society?
Absolutely. There was a long time that games were not socially accepted. I mean, it was very segregated. We went through the whole violence, the anti-video game violence stuff for a long time, but at Mortal Kombat's peak. We were getting people picketing the arcades or parents and things. And a lot of it is whatever is popular as culture moves on, whatever the young people really like. I mean, the older people are nervous by it. They don't understand it. So they tend to demonize it. Sent rock and roll in the 50s, video games in the 80s. It's happened over and over again. It'll be something else, the next decade. But it's okay. I mean, I've seen that happen over and over again. I mean, today it seems kind of ridiculous that it was a big deal about video game violence, but it was massive. I mean, we had Congress coming down and looking into what we were doing. Everyone was trying to pass laws outlawing violent video games. We got involved in lawsuits, freedom of speech, and a lot of the laws that were passed were overturned because they violated First Amendment rights. Because at the end of the day, it is an art form, and it's freedom of speech. So I've seen a lot of things happen like that. Today, though, it's really not an issue. I mean, the games aren't, violent to be gratuitous violent. I mean, it's not like that's the whole point of the game, maybe like it was once upon a time, and that's really not the issue anymore. I see games becoming, I think games are much more socially accepted today because a lot of people that are 40 and 50 years old kind of grew up playing games, and it's okay to play games, guys like me that have been playing games our whole life. And so I think attitudes have definitely changed. I think people are feeling different about online presence. Things like Facebook have changed the way people view being online, interacting with other people online. And so, it is dramatically different than it was. I've seen it change over and over again. It keeps evolving. And it's going to continue. I mean, that process is going to continue. I don't really think of really any real negative issues today about games. The biggest issues today are, so well, some of the sexism issues that come up because the girl gamers think the girl programmers think that the guys are being unfair about them, and sometimes they are, but it's kind of silly stuff. It's all minor stuff. What I really see, what I'm really excited about, is people accepting games as art now. When I see the Smithsonian doing art exhibitions, and I see the Museum of Modern Art, picking up a Pac-Man and putting it on permanent exhibition, and people are recognizing games for what they are, it really is a expressive art form. I think that's really cool because I've always believed that, and to me, it says, okay, well, we're growing up as a culture, and we know that it doesn't have to be. Art is not narrowly defined by this one thing. It's a much broader, and you can express art in lots of different ways. And interactive media is a valid art form. And I still know people today that will deny that, but I don't think it's true. And I think it's becoming more and more obvious that it's becoming accepted as a legitimate art form today, interactive media. And a few years ago, it really wasn't. There's still a lot of argument about it, but that argument's kind of going away. So I think we'll continue to see that evolution taking place. And as culture shifts, it'll continue on.
Would you care to tell us your personal experience with the, I guess you could say, dog days of gaming, like when it was demonized?
Wow. The weirdest thing I ever did is I got deposed for a lawsuit with a municipality here in the United States. That actually became a test case, and I got called into as a witness, kind of representing arcade operators in America, and that was probably at our peak. We had about nearly 500 shopping mall arcades in the United States. We had most of the arcades in the U.S. at our peak, and that was probably late 90s. At one point, I felt kind of weird about it because I felt like I was the poster child for violent video games. I was out there saying, well, you know, this law is unconstitutional and you can't do this. And I was like, okay, well, I mean, I love playing games. I mean, do I think some games are over the top? You know, and they were just kind of doing some things just to generate attention? Yeah, they were, of course. Yeah, it happens in every media. But that wasn't the point. It was like, and that didn't last very long. It was done. The first time you do something that's really over the top, everyone gets a lot of attention, and it's out there, and yes, you can make money at it. But the second and third time you do it, it's just not as unusual anymore. And so eventually, from an economic standpoint, that all kind of goes away. But when games were demonized, I felt like weird because I was running the arcade chains in America. I mean, I was running the big arcade chain, and there were a lot of times that I felt like, you know, people were kind of demonizing arcades and demonizing games. It was like, wow. There were times I felt like it was a personal attack. You know, that people were saying, well, you know, I might as well be a drug dealer because I've got all these video games out here that are corrupting our youth and they're bad for perceptions of reality by our kids. I'm messing all these kids' minds. And there were times that was hard. You know, because I didn't think that. I didn't believe it. But and I thought it was really unfair because I think it's the social phenomenon. It's people that are uncomfortable with this new product and this new art, and they don't know what it is. And so if they don't know what it is, they don't understand it, and they don't take the time to understand it, then it's wrong. And you always have that in society, and you always have that in culture. And that we went through that process in games, and that was tough, you know. But you know, you get through it. And today it's largely gone. I really don't see those issues anymore. But that was hard, you know, for a while. You know, and then on a really cold, I remember I worked with guys, and they were like, you know what? Yeah, they're making a lot of fuss. And we literally had people picketing, you know, like adults picketing in front of the arcades because we had violent video games. And the sad part is, it drove sales. Yeah. So the more attention you got and the more publicity they got, and suddenly everyone's got to come out to see why they're picketing. And so the more that people picketed and the more complaining they did, the higher the sales went up. And so it was a real catch-22. It was like, you know, I really feel bad that you guys are out here doing this, but, you know, the business, it's not exactly hurting the business. So you just kind of live with it and deal with it and deal with it the best you can. And, you know, frankly, it probably helped the business for a few years.
That's an interesting aspect, gaining sales through...
Yeah, well, I mean, it's controversy. I mean, so as soon as someone says, oh my God, these things are horrible, everyone's got to come out to see it, right? So that's what happened. As soon as it was on the news and how horrible they were, then suddenly everybody had to come in and play it and see how horrible it really was. And it literally, I remember talking about it with the guys, it was actually literally when they were doing news stories and they were picketing, it was driving sales. It drove the sales up when they did that stuff. It was weird. It was ironic. But at the end of the day, it was a tempest in a teapot. It didn't matter because it was literally just something that was very short-lived, and it wasn't, you know, those games were done that way with the ultra-violence just to generate attention, you know, and that's fine. It served an audience, and it did what it was supposed to do, and that's terrific, but it wasn't going to last long, you know. It wasn't, because that's, either it's a great game or it's not, and the most famous one is, you know, Mortal Kombat. Mortal Kombat's a great game. It's a great fighting game. It would have been a great fighting game without the ripping out the guy's heart, you know, or ripping out the spine. But that generated a lot of attention. It probably cemented its place in history as a really fabulous fighting game. It would have been a good fighting game regardless. But yeah, honestly, being known for that probably just helps everyone to know the name Mortal Kombat. It helped it. Yeah.
So just going off the selling aspect, how would you say Namco reaches out to gamers and non-gamers alike to play their games?
You know, I think it depends on the games and it depends on the platforms. We do a lot of different platforms now. Do a lot of mobile games, you know, for phones and tablets, and we still do. We're still one of the last, I think, great manufacturers of coin-op games, in quotes. And we still do a lot of console games, and we do a great job, I think, a lot of the console games. So I think they said, you know, and I'm not involved with all these things. I'm involved primarily on the coin-op side. But when we sit down and we talk about how do we do things that are attractive. We really, each of us, talk about our platforms and the markets for those platforms, and then try to find ways to do the things that they want us to do. I mean, every game is out there, and they're literally targeted to a specific audience, and we're trying to build something that audience wants to see. No matter if it's a new game, or if it's a new arcade, or if it's a new entertainment facility, we're definitely trying to position that thing that fits a need or a desire by a certain market segment. So I think that the ways you do that, it just depends on the platform. And we do it by trying to find a way to speak to our guys either online or in person, because a lot of what we do is personal. And the advantage we have on the arcade side is we build a relationship one-on-one with a person, as opposed to trying to build a relationship so that you will buy our software at a retail store and put it in the game. We actually are looking at you face-to-face. I think the disadvantage that guys like, the guys that do the disc for Xbox and PlayStation and Wii and our sister company, is that they're building something and they're designing this great game, and they go through their testing procedures and they get to do their, let players come in and try it out and get all the feedback. And they do. They do a lot of that. They get a lot of player feedback. They do lots of player testing. They do all this stuff to really try to make sure they're doing what fits the market. And even then, though, designing a new game is kind of it can be a crapshoot. I mean, honestly, you're never going to know 100% what the game's going to do until you put it on the shelf and get it out there. But they do all this work, but it's really hard for them, because I think it's harder for them in some ways. They don't get to have that personal one-on-one relationship. So they don't get to, when we establish a new facility like this, we're in it every day and we're talking to the guest and we're talking to the players and we're getting that direct feedback. When you're talking about console games, you're getting feedback online forums and you're getting, and there's always a vocal minority. So I always worry that you're getting filtered feedback when you start talking about what people are posting online, because you're not getting the whole story. You're getting the story from the vocal minority. But, I mean, at the end of the day, I think we all sit down and try to figure out what's going to work best for the market and put it out there. Again, it's different for every platform. I can't even tell you how they do it for some of these guys, because I know they go through a lot of work to try to dial everything in for their audience. And we do. And even doing that, you make mistakes and you have to back up and try again. And every gamer knows that. Very rarely does a new game come out that, okay, well, we got to download some new patches because this didn't work, or everyone hated this play mechanic, or, there's always something. So no matter how good you are, you're always going to go back and probably end up retooling a little bit.
Have you gotten feedback from, customers that used to play coin-op games?
At 257?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we've actually, it's been a lot of fun. So we've had people playing games. So the fun part for me here at this site is getting people that haven't played games in years or decades and talking them into going back and saying, just try playing this stuff. And I've had people that were 60-something years old and I've gotten to go back and play some games. And it's like, okay, I'll play Asteroids. Yeah, all right, let me try it. I haven't played it in 30 years, but okay, fine, I'll play Asteroids again, or I'll play Centipede. And it's a lot of fun because suddenly they start playing and it's exactly what we wanted to happen. They're enjoying it. And as soon as they start enjoying it, we can start having conversations about the other games back there. And we tried to make it really accessible and really inclusive. So if you don't want to play Asteroids, that's fine. If you want to play chess, I got a chess set back there. You want to play backgammon, play for free. I don't care. You can play board games. You want to play board games, card games, play them. That's fine. Just sit back here, hang out, relax, play. If you do that for a little bit, though, you're probably going to say, I should go play Centipede and try it. I should go play Pac-Man and try it out again just for old time's sake. And as soon as that happens, then we can start to get them excited about gameplay again. And that was part of our deal here, is games are so great. I wanted to get people to try it again that haven't played it in years. And that's been fun for me here, is getting some of those people to play it again. And we've had a lot of people do that, and that's been a thrill for me. I've had people back there that had literally said, I haven't played games in decades. It's like, okay, we'll just try it. You don't have to worry about it. Don't worry about the pricing. Don't worry about what it costs. Just go back and play. Here, have a card. Next hour, you can activate any game in here. Play what you want. Yeah. Or sit down and have a drink. Whatever you want to do. You can do whatever you want. But just try it. And when you start to take off all those limitations and all the barriers, it becomes a lot more accessible, and they start realizing they're having fun. And that's been a blast. I've enjoyed the heck out of that, getting people to play games that haven't played games in years. That's been fun. So, yeah. So we've had a lot of feedback on that, too. And I've had a lot of positive feedback. You always get a little negative feedback too, but I try to take even the negative feedback as a positive, so we learn from it and move on. Yeah, it's been good. I that's been one of the pluses of what we've done here, yeah, is the positive feedback we've gotten from our goal there was to be able to play games that don't normally play games, and it's working. So I've been really excited by that.
Just to wrap up, you say a lot of the people that are playing these coin op games usually have history with it or have like played it one time in their lives and come to play it again. Where do you see, in your personal opinion, the future of coin op going as far as like gameplay or like audience?
Well, it won't be coin op. It'll be another type of payment system. But you know, I think it's becoming. I think the style of gameplay is going to be largely the same, because it's really, when you're talking about an environment like this, you don't have a half hour to learn how to play a game. You're talking about something you got to be able to pick up and play it, you know, relatively naturally, you know, and you can't have a big barrier or obstacle there to figure out how to play it and have a good time with it. And we want people to have a good time quickly, pick it up and go. So I think that style is going to continue on. I think the mechanism that we deliver it's going to change. I think technology is going to force us to change that. I think that what you're seeing now is a new evolution in games, and a lot of it comes back to the barcades and guys, and they're using old games, but they're making games really socially acceptable again with older people that haven't played games in a long time. I love that about barcades and about the fact they're taking all this wave of nostalgia and bringing these games back. I think you're going to continue to see that. And again, that was part of our motivation here. Let's take that, because that's starting to work, and let's use that as a launching board to get people to see some of the new stuff that we're doing, because some of the new technology we have today and the stuff coming down the line over the next couple of years is really amazing. And we've got to get that in front of people again. And until we can get them out there just having a good time, it's really tough to get them to see and have an open mind about, hey, let's try out this new technology. So try out this hemispherical screens, try out this new head-mounted display. And there's a lot of obstacles with that, but I think technology is going to change a lot of the delivery systems that we have. And that'll be the fun part experimenting with, to see what people will accept and what they won't accept, and how it changes the way we interact, not just with us versus the machine, but us against another person or with another person. Cooperative play. I love cooperative play as opposed to maybe even competitive play. And I think that you'll see a lot more cooperative play in the stuff that we're doing in the future in this environment, as opposed to competitive. You know, it's not necessarily you against the other person, but you and the other person working together toward a common goal.
Just last question. Not really a question, but is there anything that you would like to add or tell everybody, like, that hasn't been covered already or that they should know?
Games are fun. I hope everyone knows that already. But if not, everyone should know that games are fun. It's okay to play games, I think games are a big part of what we're going to be doing in the future still. It's a really important part of my life. I hope it's an important part of everybody's life going forward. And I think it will be.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. Thank you for accepting the interview.
Thanks, guys. No, thanks for coming out.